CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, BC, striving to provide points of view that are rarely expressed in mainstream media.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the biggest art fraud ring in the world. It happened, well, where else? In Thunder Bay.
That freaking scumbag.
Yeah.
If I had 6 months to live, I'd shoot him. I'd be doing society a favor. That man ruined a lot of people's lives for no reason.
The late Norval Morisot is known as Canada's Picasso.
Many times people come up to me and say, Norval, I thank you very much for healing me. I thank you very much for helping me. I thank you very much for doing this. I have never seen those people. What did it? The painting.
He was the father of the woodland style. He created an entire genre. And whether you know much about art or not, I don't, you would recognize it. This is that style of painting that looks both ancient and like cutting edge modern at the same time. Highly graphic. Bold outlines and x-rays, animals, people, spiritual elements, colors that are incredibly vivid. You have seen versions of this everywhere. Well, all of that started with Norval Morisot. He made the avant-garde fine art world take Indigenous painters seriously. His work was exhibited at the Pompidou Center in Paris, the National Gallery of Canada, the Art Gallery of Newport. He was appointed to the Order of Canada. Norval Morisot is without question one of the most important painters in Canadian history. So how come I can go onto eBay and buy a so-called original Morisot for $129? The answer is fraud. The market has been flooded with thousands, literally thousands, of fake Norval Morisot paintings and prints. And most of them were churned out at a fake art mill that was exposed to be operating in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
There's little debate over whether Norval Morisot ranks among the most iconic and influential artists of his era. What there is some debate about, however, is the authenticity of some of the works that bear his name.
Police in Ontario have arrested a group of people responsible for manufacturing and distribution of what they say is fake artwork from well-known Indigenous artist Norval Morisot.
Now, after a 2.5-year investigation, Ontario Provincial Police and Thunder Bay Police say they've cracked a major forgery ring, seizing more than 1,000 paintings and prints. 8 Ontario residents, 5 are from Thunder Bay, including a nephew of Morisot, have been charged.
Earlier this month, one David Voss was sentenced to 5 years in prison after pleading guilty to forgery charges for orchestrating this art fraud ring. Voss had been initially charged back in March 2023 following a multi-year investigation by the Thunder Bay Police Service. At sentencing, the judge said, quote, "The damage is profound. This is more than just an art fraud. It is the appropriation of a cultural and spiritual identity of one of Canada's most beloved artists." Actually, it was much worse than that. The details are sordid. And I will say before we go any further that today's episode does deal with the sexual abuse of Indigenous youth. The masterminds of this art fraud ring had connections to organized crime. They enlisted young Indigenous people to churn out and move the fakes, sometimes paying them with drugs and sometimes sexually abusing them. A member of Norval Morisot's own family was one of the people charged. This came to light thanks to a journalist, a documentary filmmaker named Jamie Kastner. You've heard him here recently talking about another story of his, a documentary all about the WikiLeaks lieutenant, Jacob Applebaum. Jamie Kastner's documentary investigation is what prompted the police investigation of the art fraud ring. And frankly, I'm jealous. Because when I was reporting in Thunder Bay with Ryan McMahon, we heard rumors and got tips about this art fraud ring. But our story took us in a different direction, and before we could fully tug on that thread, Jamie Kastner had the story. And it is a hell of a story. And both Jamie Kastner and Ryan McMahon are going to join me to tell it in a minute. As they tell it, you will hear clips from Jamie Kastner's documentary, which is called There Are No Fakes. That's a film that you should also check out. Kastner and McMahon join me in a moment. Wait for it. Ryan, take me back to the beginning. When did this art fraud, counterfeit art ring story first come to your attention?
I had heard rumors back in the mid-2010s that there were a handful of people out there claiming that they owned fake Norval Morisots. And there were complaints on the internet from something called the Norval Morisot Heritage Society that were working on behalf of what they claimed was Norval Morisot's legacy. And this was a collection of institutional folks, artists, art experts, art historians that were acting on behalf of Norval and his body of work, and trying to protect the long rumored reality that there were this ring of fraudsters out there working together to create fake paintings. And during season one of making the Thunder Bay podcast, you know, people were saying this is something you should look into, and we just couldn't get our footing, really. I mean, I heard the name over and over again, Gary Lamont, but I was hearing the name Gary Lamont, who, of course, now we know is one of the fraudsters, but I was hearing his name in a very different context.
He was a white guy, pretty big, scary.
I learned that how deeply involved Gary Lamont was in what was going on.
Gary Lamont?
Yeah, Gary Lamont.
Who is he? How does he
feel? Gary Lamont, I met him. He was selling Norval Morisot paintings on eBay.
Gary Lamont was a drug dealer in Thunder Bay here. He's well known for being a biker, a badass.
He was rumored to have killed Scott Dove in Thunder Bay. He had never been charged for that, I should say. And these rumors were unsubstantiated at the time.
So there was an inquest, I'm learning, in 1986 into the murder of this teenager, Scott Dove. He was 17 when he was killed. And at that inquest, two witnesses testified about death threats they had allegedly received from Gary Lamont after Lamont had learned that they had been speaking with the police about the case. So in effect, Lamont was identified publicly as a murder suspect at that inquest.
Lamont was a very feared individual. We were going to try to talk to Lamont because we had heard that he had fostered children from the north that came into Thunder Bay to go to school and that he owned a number of rental properties. So we had started down that road. But again, the timing of the story, the resource we had and how deep we were in our investigation already, we just didn't ever end up landing that story. And so it was in our purview, but it was kind of one of those things that just escaped our hands, I guess, at the time.
So as I recall it, we're looking at the deaths of all of these indigenous teenagers in Thunder Bay, and we're looking at the relationship they have with these foster homes where they're away from these northern communities for the first time and the standard of care and the various motives that people had for taking these kids in. And then here is this, like, out of left field curveball that the famous painter Norval Morisot, genius, the Picasso of the North, there is a fraud ring allegedly counterfeiting his works that involves this Gary Lamont character, and it involves child abuse of kids who go to the school. I mean, I was very intrigued by this, and we did sequels to Thunder Bay. I was very interested to dig into this with you and figure out what the heck was going on, but then we found out that somebody else was already on the story. Jamie Kastner, who happens to be here in the studio with me and who wrote and directed the documentary There Are No Fakes. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
So, from your perspective, when did you first learn about this story?
I learned about it, I believe it was 2014, when I took my old high school buddy, Kevin Hearn, to lunch with a view to getting him interested in doing a documentary on Lou Reed.
This is Kevin Hearn of the Bare Naked Ladies.
Little did I know, you know, the spider web was around me. $20,000. What's the price?
Since 1995, I've been with the Bare Naked Ladies.
If all else fails, you can blame it on me.
sold over 15 million records. We're nominated for a couple Grammys. We also did the theme song for the Big Bang Theory show.
I was wondering when the Bernicke ladies were going to enter the
story. Oh, them. That same Kevin Hearn had a little side gig running Lou Reed's live band for the last 7 years of Lou's life. The Lou Reed thing didn't come to pass, but at this lunch, Kevin said to me, you know, you make documentaries. I'm involved in this other kind of court battle. Maybe this would be of interest to you. And he told me basically the bones of the whole tale that started with him suing a gallery owner in Yorkville over what turned out to be a, then we called them allegedly fake paintings.
Kevin Hearn bought an original, he thought, Norval Morisot from an art dealer and then learned that it might be fake.
That's right. Kevin had bought what he believed to be a real Norval Morisot painting from a seemingly reputable gallery called Maslach McLeod in Yorkville, in Tony Yorkville, in Midtown
fancy.
Toronto. Then a couple of months later, he was displaying it in a kind of little celebrity curated show at the AGO, and the then curator of Canadian art ordered that this painting be taken down because it was a fake.
I feel in this story I'm just a little like Alice in Wonderland. I went through the little door and it's just opened up into this whole like, wow. I just wanted to buy a painting, really.
And it turns out that these rumors of these fakes have been circulating in art and indigenous worlds for decades. I now know it was something of an open secret that you could, you know, go places like Manitoulin Island or whatever and buy all the quote-unquote Morisots you wanted at bargain basement prices. So Kevin buys this painting from this gallery. Its authenticity is called into question by a reputable curator. He goes back to the gallery in Yorkville, tries to resolve it. The guy says, you know, get stuffed, basically. So Kevin launches a suit against him. Once Kevin does that, he finds himself in the middle of these two feuding factions who are at each other's throats over the authenticity of a tranche of Morisot's work, estimated at about 3,000 paintings.
3,000 paintings.
3,000 paintings.
That suggests like an almost industrial operation.
Absolutely. It's an industrial operation and an investment and a substantial amount of money at stake that people have invested in these things.
When did this start happening? When did these fakes start being produced?
There have been stories in the mainstream media about these fakes, at least going back to 2000.
Ryan, my question again is, like, if you're running a sophisticated and robust enough criminal operation that you're putting out 3,000 fake paintings in a town as small as Thunder Bay, there are going to be rumors and whispers, and that those rumors and whispers reached you. So, like, what was your kind of, like, dawning awareness of what was going on?
My dawning awareness of what was going on really came when I bought a fake.
This is news to me.
Well, you're not alone, sadly.
How did you learn that the one you bought was a fake?
Well, thanks to the work of Jamie Kastner and TVO and the fakes crew that put this work out into the world, I came across paths with Jonathan Summer, who is the lawyer that worked with Kevin Hearn in bringing this court case forward. And, you know, there was a link on a website. Do you think you own a fake Morisot? Would you like to know? And so I sent a photo of the thing hanging. I mean, I got to tell you, I designed my dining room around this fake,
you know. Sorry, Ryan.
It's okay. I mean, it was a beautiful dining room. The deep red wine color of the background, the three Thunderbirds careening across the sky, connected by spiritual energy and these medicine circles. You know, I went with a dark cherry wood on the dining room table, and our table runner kind of matched the red wine color of the background of the painting. And when I I emailed Summer. I said, this is what I have. And he said, oh, it's on the list of fakes.
So Jamie here cost you like, what, $10,000?
No, it was only four because it was a print. But it was one of 50, I will say. So I felt pretty damn good about going to get it. I mean, I was on tour. I'd made a bit of money on tour. And I went to the Weetung Gallery. And I was just going through a vault that they kind of just keep off to the side that no one really accesses. And I found it there. Little did I know that this was a part of the larger story.
I think that in the world of criminal conspiracies, like art fraud and art fakes, you know, can be considered, people might think it's like sort of a less abusive and sinister form of a crime, but this story gets pretty dark.
One path to determining a painting's authenticity is by following the trail of its provenance, the list of its owners, since starting with the painter. And eventually the path led to Thunder Bay. This is with the painting that Kevin had bought for $20,000. And once you got to Thunder Bay, then it got to, there was speculation at the time, speculation that there was this fraud ring that was being run by this guy named Gary Lamont.
Okay, so Lamont, we noted earlier, was a somewhat notorious drug dealer with a reputation for violence. But Jamie, as you reported, he also had a side business.
Had a side business in boarding youths from fly-in communities who were going to school in Thunder Bay. An exotic resume.
So how do these things come together? Like, Gary Lamont is this wannabe Hell's Angel who is also, for some reason, shockingly, able to get himself set up as someone who boards young indigenous kids, who rents rooms out to northern kids who have come off reserve to finish high school in Thunder Bay. How does this end up connecting to Norval Morisot and this art fraud ring?
What emerged was an almost unbelievably horrible confluence of activities in and around Gary Lamont and his various properties, in which, in no particular order, various often substance-addicted painters were coming in to sort of churn out kind of paint-by-numbers fake Morisots in an assembly line fashion, often or partially being paid with drugs that Lamont dealt. And these students who were being boarded from these far northern communities were being groomed and sexually abused by Lamont, who wound up first, in fact, being convicted of, you know, the molestation and was already doing time for that when the art fraud charges caught up with him last December.
This is horrible.
Yes.
How long was this going on for?
Years. I met someone who was part of his circle, a kid at the time, Dallas Thompson, a remarkable person who survived this monster to tell his tale.
What was Dallas's role in this operation?
He was a witness to the forgeries, the distribution of the forgeries, and was a witness to the abuse and a victim, a multiple times victim of Gary Lamont's sexual abuse. So in one very unfortunate but very remarkable person, through his testimony, to a large extent, this story could be told.
How many paintings were being done?
Hundreds. Hundreds. And at that time, that's when production was just, they're spitting them out, the Norval Morisot fakes. It was crazy that summer in 2006, 2007, we went to Calgary approximately 26 times in a 2-3 month period selling art.
How would you get there?
Driving his truck. Every time we bought a brand new 2004 GMC Sierra, something, an extended cab, and that's how we drove, me, him, and Benji. And Benji came on 90% of the trips because he was a driver, and Gary, they'd split the driving. We'd drive to Calgary, one straight shot, 23 hours, 24 hours, sell the art and, you know, sleep and be gone the next morning, drive straight back. On every trip, it was probably about 30 paintings that Gary would bring. Average price was probably around $3,000 for paintings.
Jamie, your film contains some difficult moments with Dallas where he talks about the sexual abuse that he suffered. I think it's important to hear his voice on this.
And then this room to the right of it was, there's bunk beds in there for all the native boarding students. And this is where he kept them all. And I ended up getting drugged. And then he kicked everybody out. And I had my own bedroom right beside his in the main house. And everybody else he kicked out to the guest camp and then locked the door. That night, there was like a blue light from the stereo. I remember him coming into the room. I was just thinking to myself, I'm fucked. He kept the keys on him at all times. Once he locked the door, there was no getting out. He pretty much did whatever he wanted. And I was just so fucked up. And then that's basically when I became a prisoner in his house. He threatened my life. He started threatening me. He told me once when he was raping me, he was punching me in the head. He told me that I better just go along with it or I'll end up like Scott Dove.
Ryan, did you meet anyone in Thunder Bay who had been exposed or involved in this operation or abused by it?
Yeah, well, I had formerly known Mark Anthony Jacobson, who is a Woodlands painter who claims to have painted in apprenticeship form with Norval. And Jacobson said that there was some very, very scary people around Norval Morso. We should say that Lamont was friends or at least acquaintances with Norval Morso, that Norval spent time with Lamont in and around Thunder Bay. And we learned that at times Lamont was providing shelter for Norval, and Norval would stay at his cottage or some sort of cabin-like building that Lamont allegedly owned. I've been told by multiple sources that Norval actually fled Thunder Bay in the end to get away from Gary Lamont because Lamont was a toxic force in his life. And so there's a lot of talk for those people in the know, kind of in the circle around like whether or not Norval Morso was complicit in allowing these fakes or whether he knew or did not know. I'm in receipt of affidavits that Norval Morso himself put out into the universe to say that, in fact, he was trying to stop the fakes. So it's not true that Norval gave Lamont permission to produce these fakes. But the troubling truth is that they did have a relationship at some time in Thunder Bay. This is known in the city. And I think just proves just how complicated the Morso fakes story is. You know, it's a really complex story with a lot of starts and stops through the decades.
Again, you have to remember that Morso had come from a place of incredible poverty, you know, had grown up in a place, you know, with a dirt floor. And then by the time he's in his early 20s, he's suddenly being catapulted, unlike any Indigenous artist before him, into sort of mainstream stardom. He's got big gallery shows that are selling out in a second in downtown Toronto, and news reporters are all over him. And, you know, he's a rock star. He's suddenly a rock star. My understanding is that, you know, he initially wanted to help out as he became famous and partied and lived it up like rock stars do.
And attracts predators and yeah, hangers-on and leeches and
all of the above.
The other thing I would say about Norval being a rock star and kind of his life moving fast, I mean, I think we should also mention that while his rise was relatively fast, I believe he also grew up in a complicated time. I mean, I think it's safe to say he was a bisexual man that had relationships with men and women. I think it's safe to say due to his life, like, yeah, he lived a hard life. He grew up in a trap line and went to residential school and suffered abuses there. And objectively, one might say he failed as a family man. He failed his wife who divorced him. He didn't raise his children the way that maybe we'd hope a father would raise his children. And so in terms of the complications of his life and his rise to notoriety, I think, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight here, and we look back on Norval as as someone that people are quick to label as an alcoholic and a drug addict. And that's why it's so complicated to know which paintings he painted on the street and which are fake and which he painted well inebriated or which he painted to rush because he had a gallery show and didn't have any artwork. I mean, he's a complicated figure that grew up at a time where I believe he had little support. I think that what I know from the record is that, you know, he was surrounded by non-Indigenous people. Everybody wanted a piece of Norvel Morso, and everyone got a piece of Norvel Morso.
I mean, you just introduced something new into the conversation, which seems relevant, which is that because this guy painted masterpieces and he had shoddier work, he had, you know, quickie stuff at his prime, he had stuff when he was desperate, that also muddies and complicates the whole question of, is this a real Morso? Well, maybe it is a real Morso, just not one of the better ones.
Absolutely. And I think the ups and downs and various trails that his life took him on did make creating what is called a catalogue raisonné of an artist's work, which is to say an authoritative index of all his work, somewhat more complicated than, say, if a banker happened to have a talent and only leave home on the weekends.
I mean, this is a huge understatement because the market value of Morisot's work, the legacy of Morisot, the visual history of Morisot compared to other artists, like, okay, any major artist is going to get counterfeited and there's going to be fakes. 3,000 fakes. You said earlier that he took Indigenous art from the gift shop to the gallery. These fakes were not being sold at galleries. There was still trade shows. There were so many of them flooding the market that they were just being cheaply hustled off. Like, he was not served well during his life, and his legacy has not been served well to the point now where I think it's really cratered what a Morisot is worth.
I think the other thing we have to talk about in terms of timing and what happened here with Norvel Morisot and the fakes is the internet. And when these fraud rings started to leverage the internet, before the age of social media, they were using very rudimentary websites to upload low-res versions of photos of these works, and they would get them out to market that way. And so in terms of, like, the number of fakes and the timing, it's almost a perfect storm. It could never happen again. And I think that the question of timing and when this all started and when it all went down and when it was popularized by the auction houses and other places that had these works for sale, this was as close to a perfect storm as you could get in terms of the timing and the tools used.
Jamie, it wasn't like your documentary came out and then the cops saw it and then they turned their sirens on and went and made arrests. It took a while, and it was a bit of a circuitous route from your documentary investigation to their police investigation, finally leading to charges and convictions. Can you tell me, how did the forgers finally get caught?
It's so rare and wonderfully rewarding, is it not? Because you guys have had this experience as well, when you actually do a piece of journalism and it actually leads somewhere in the real world. My film, There Are No Fakes, came out in 2019. And at that time, the parents of a murder victim in Thunder Bay, a cold case named Scott Dove, told the detective who had recently taken up this 20-year-plus, I believe, cold case, that he should watch this film, There Are No Fakes. The detective's name is Jason Ryback of the Thunder Bay Police. Scott Dove is mentioned in this film, telling the whole story of these Morisot fakes, because the then-alleged, now-convicted ringleader of this one fraud ring, Gary Lamont, mm-hmm. was the prime suspect in the murder of this kid, Scott Dove. And this fact is mentioned in the film. So the parents saw it. They told this detective he should watch this film. And the detective saw the story that follows the trail all the way up to Thunder Bay and then in and around of where these paintings come from and in what circumstances. By then, Gary Lamont is already serving time for the molestation of minors. And this detective decides that this art fraud case should also be investigated.
In the process of investigating the murder of Scott Dove, allegedly by Lamont.
That's right. He's on the Scott Dove case. He hears about the film. He realizes there's this vast art fraud involving some of the same people that overlaps with this cold case.
The murder investigation leads to an art fraud ring investigation.
tied in with a child molester, a convicted child molester. So they launch a 2.5-year investigation. It's a collaboration between the Thunder Bay Police and the OPP. They interview scores and scores of people. They wind up in March 2023 with appropriate fanfare, announcing 8 arrests, 40 charges laid, and the seizure of 1,000 paintings.
This has to be the biggest art fraud ring in Canadian history.
According to the police, it's actually the largest art fraud ring in world history.
As measured by the number of fakes?
By the number of fakes, exactly. Not the value, which ironically is kept down by the rumors, by the fact of the fakes,
yeah,
but by the sheer number. At the time I was looking into this, it was estimated to be 3,000 of this questionable species. By the time the cops made their arrests and laid their charges, they were saying north of 6,000. And